Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Adam White, he's ready to go on a Tuesday morning. Postmaster's Tuesday. He loves it. Hello, Adam White.
No one's called me that, Daniel. And my wife would be laughing at you by saying such a thing. But anyway, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Nervous times, I must say. I'd say... And in the outer eastern suburbs of Melbourne, the outer northeastern suburbs of Melbourne, there may have been a little bit of a frost situation today. Nervous times with the young grass.
Oh, the Tiff Tough.
The young Tiff Tough. No, I'm not sure whether it really should be enduring such a thing early in its infancy.
I'm concerned about this. I mentioned this a long time ago. I'm
well,
not sure
I know.
Any attention
no,
or not?
Well, we did. It was a. We're working to a very tough timeline, but we got the beautiful rain over the weekend. You could see it really embracing that precipitation, but we don't want frost.
Well, I'm concerned about your Tiff Tough. I'm not sure how tough your Tiff is at this stage of the season. I think there's a real concern going forward for the grass. Having said all that, I did mow my lawn on Saturday, and boy, did I time that well. Did I time that well. Ha! I had to go and get the next door neighbour's mower. Because mine's in the shop, getting an update, getting a bit of a grease and oil change. But I had to get it done because I knew... Well, you saw the length of it 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I was
worried. It hadn't been touched since that point. So it needed to be cut, but I didn't have the mower back. So I was really at a quandary, didn't know what to do. But found a way to knock on the door and he was there and he was out there doing his own thing with the edger. I said, can I just borrow your mower? And he said, no worries. Real sort of neighbourly stuff. Fantastic it was. Fantastic it was.
Very good.
So it was good. So I'm concerned about your grass. I am concerned about your grass.
Anyway, we obviously followed yesterday the fortunes of the Masters, and in the end it was one of the more comfortable one-shot victories I think I can remember in the Masters. It never felt like it was a one-shot victory. Obviously, Hideki Matsuyama had some issues a little bit towards the end, but others did as well.
Yes.
But just the significance, and I know we're going to chat to Ben Everill from the PGA Tour shortly, who's been a long-time friend of ours, but the significance around dealing with the mental pressure, don't worry about the other members of the field, but just what he knew that would have done to sport in Japan, probably the world in Japan, and the ramifications of him winning.
Yep.
They're now saying that there's a big chance that he's going to carry the flag into the Olympic Games opening ceremony, a home Olympic Games. There's talk that he could be worth $1 billion.
I did see. I had to check that twice.
Now this is very much them talking in generalities, but just around probably more his brand.
Yep.
As a result of becoming the first Japanese winner, men's winner of a major championship. And it's an interesting story with him because, you know, he at one point, probably 3 or 4 years ago, he got to number two in the world. He's won a WGC event. He's won the event at Jack's Place, the Memorial. In the last 5 years, he's been inside the top six in ball striking. So that's sort of, you know, greens in regulation sort of thing.
Yes.
Iron play into greens, into the hole. But his putting has been the one thing that has let him down. And if you think over the last 10 years, we've had now Matsuyama, along with Adam Scott and Sergio Garcia, win at the Masters, when it's always been felt that you need to be a really good putter to win at the Masters because of the undulations and because of the hardness, the firmness, the challenge of the greens, that he was able to find a way to win like Scott and Garcia did, who you know both say are not very good putters. So I don't know necessarily what it means, but it kind of goes against what we all thought. Now, the counter-argument to that is that you need to be an exceptional ball striker to give yourself a chance of getting as many birdie putts as possible and to stay out of trouble. And I think essentially that's what Matsuyama did.
But I think that's the key, yeah.
Yeah, but it goes back to what had happened on that after that rain delay. He sat in his car playing computer games on his phone, waiting for the rain to stop, went back out there and shot. Was it 30 on the back nine, and just put a break on the field, and ultimately that was the difference.
Now, I read, John's got an SMS here, he's not the first Asian to win a major. I read four articles yesterday that told me he was.
No, first Japanese player.
Well,
Wei Yi Yang won the PGA as a South Korean. Remember when the commentator went, Wei Yi Yang, Wei Yi Yes?
Well, here's the headlines from the three stories that I read yesterday. They come up my Google searches. I'm searching for it. Japan's Hideki Yoshiyama becomes first Asian-born golfer to win Masters. It's effectively the same headline three times that I've read in three different stories.
Well, what's the...
I don't know. It says Asian-born. It's very specific about that. I don't know what happens there. Anyway.
Wei Yang won the PGA, didn't win the Masters.
No, that's true. To win Masters. Ah, yes. I said major. Okay, yes. No, that makes sense.
So Wei Yi Yang was...
When was that? Is that 2009-ish? 2010?
About that, yeah.
Hang on, I've got it up here. 2009, it was.
Yeah. So that was... He beat Tiger. I mean, Tiger was thereabouts in that. He didn't really do much after. There's a lot of golfers that won the PGA that... some real random results that didn't really do much after that. Remember Rich Beam was one of those. Rich Kevin Streelman, there's quite a few.
David Toms. Mark Brooks, ever heard of Mark Brooks since?
Mark Brooks.
Ever heard of Mark Brooks?
Yeah, no, he almost won a US Open.
Paul Azinger? Zinger. He won the PGA. Jeff Sluman. Those are great names.
Mm.
Great names won the PGA. And, of course, your mate Colin Morikawa, who won it, I remember watching that a couple of years ago, last year.
When we had COVID.
When he dominated.
Yeah.
Hasn't been seen since. What's happened to Cole?
No, he's around. He's not
played very well, though.
Yeah, he was. He's been around, but he hasn't been. Look, when he won, it looked like he was going to win everything. So anyway, unfortunately, from an Australian perspective, Mark Leishman just couldn't get it going early in his round. We talked about that as it was kind of unfolding, but he and Cam Smith both finished inside the top 10. Cam Smith particularly seemed disappointed. He feels that his golf course suits him and he should be contending.
You emotional?
Yeah, I am a bit. He should be contending, not so much contending, but really in the action as opposed to just floating around that sort of between sort of 7 and 15. So, anyway, a good text here. Remember Jumbo Ozaki? He used to use the big T's.
Yes, he used to love Jumbo.
And then there's a Asayo Ozaki.
There was three of the Ozaki boys.
Yeah, there was quite a few.
Ozaki boys. There was Jumbo, Asayo, and Jet.
There you go. That's right.
Jumbo and Jet.
Good memory.
Only reason I remember Jet was because they were talking about it on the coverage yesterday somewhere.
I remember Jumbo Ozaki had the big tees, and then there was Shigeki Maruyama, who was the President's Cup hero with Craig Parry. Shingo Katayama used to wear the massive hat.
Who's my man with the really slow swing? Mark Allen's favourite. What's his name? I remember. KJ.
KJ Choi. Oh yeah, that was Marco's.
Marco loves him.
He's Korean.
He's still KJ Choi.
Yeah.
Still KJ. That's what he is. We'll catch up with Benny Everill shortly on talk about the ramifications for our man Hideki and Japanese golf. Mike Clayton wrote a good article yesterday talking about the pressure. Like, we remember the Adam Scott pressure and, you know, finally breaking through from an Australian perspective. He says magnify that by 10. I reckon probably magnify it by 100.
Yeah.
And understand what Hideki was going through yesterday. Maybe that's why there was a little bit of vomit through the middle part of the back nine.
Absolutely. But I mean, he's won 5 or 6 times on the PGA Tour, but it's been a while since he's won. As I said before, I mean, he's now ranked about 25 in the world, but did get to number 2.
Yep.
I think the other thing with Adam Scott was that it wasn't just trying to be the first Australian, but he was also carrying the weight of the Greg Norman dramas, over the heartache over the years. That was the extra baggage that Adam was carrying, that he was going to be another Greg Norman, you know, that we'd been scarred by it. So that was the additional pressure that he had to take. But anyway.
Did you see, what was I going to say to you before I was rudely interrupted? Ah! Everyone was listening yesterday. They were all listening yesterday. Did you see that? That now they want, there's a push, so they say, for a pre-grand final bye. Get rid of the pre-finals bye and a pre-grand final bye. They were listening to the Breakfast Club yesterday and they thought, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make a back page story out of this. Samuel Ansberger loves the show and that's exactly what he's done. There's a push, Whitey, to get the grand final, the break, instead of being at the end of the home and away between the finals, end of the preliminary finals between the grand final, NFL style, Pro Bowl style.
Yes.
They're listening. Well, what chance of it happening this year is the question. And if you want to have your say on it, 1-300-652-927 or 0416-90-50-52. Yay or nay to the pre-grand final instead of pre-finals bye?
Well, the whole idea of the bye between the regular season and the final series, the understanding was it was to make the final series as high quality as possible with the best players available.
And I subscribed to it. And I was on the whiteboard and thought it's a fantastic idea, subscribe to it.
Yeah. So do we then give up on that just so someone who maybe get concussed in the preliminary final is available for the grand final? Or what's, in your view, what's more important?
The grand final's more important.
Well, the grand final is more important, but from a spectacle perspective, is it to give the chance for the final series or for the grand final?
I think you want to have the best chance for the grand final, because it's not necessarily about, I mean, all the talk at the moment is about the impact of a possible concussion on the back of Chelsea Randall, who was officially ruled out yesterday of the AFLW grand final this week between Adelaide and Brisbane on Saturday afternoon. Check your local guides. All the talk is about concussion, but this will just be that extra week for players who are, by the end of a season, are absolutely carrying niggles and injuries, to just give themselves another week to get better. And then you get a better contest. So I think upon reflection and with the possibility now of a pre-grand final bye, if I was to have one of all, or the other, one,
yeah,
one or the other, I would have the pre-grand final bye rather than the pre-finals bye.
Okay.
Because the data suggests in recent years that the qualifying finalists or the top four teams aren't as advantaged as they previously were, and you need to have some reward for your effort through the 22 matches you play through the home and away season. So let's reward that. Let's give them that chance to progress as far as they can. Doesn't mean the teams in the bottom four can't progress. It's just a bit harder. But we want to make sure that the pinnacle of the sport, the absolute piece de resistance, is the best product possible. And you do that by making the players as fresh as possible. And that would be a pre-grand final buy.
Mm.
That's what I reckon.
Yes. Yes, interesting.
You? Interesting. You want the finals?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not a massive rap for the break between the home and away season and the final series. I understand why it's there. I certainly understand why you would guard against the potential of a superstar missing a grand final because of concussion. I think it would be a good message to send around how seriously the AFL is taking concussion by putting that gap in there. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm going to sit on the fence on that one. I'm not sure.
You can do that.
Hey, before we speak to Ben Everill, we've got to talk about Ben Cunnington as well. But I know Ralph is going to join us a little bit later on. The interesting thing around this 100 in the UK with the new tournament they're having, the 100 ball type match.
Oh, right.
And they've come out overnight in the UK that they're not going to call it wickets.
What do you mean?
If you get you don't get a wicket, you don't take 3 for 7, which means you've taken 3 wickets, they're going to be renamed outs.
Right.
And they're not batsmen, they're batters.
Right.
So they're trying to, the idea is that they're trying to tap into the younger audience. They're trying to
appeal to the US market.
Well, I've got no, well,
baseball
exactly.
Market.
Well, it's the baseball market, but this is what they're trying to do, all these new things to tap into the younger audience. And I think this sort of language change is going to make a difference.
I'm not sure it is.
Well, I don't think it is either.
In the end, you're still going to take 3 for 7. No one ever says you take 3 wickets for 7 runs. They say you take 3 for 7. So it actually doesn't matter, does it?
Well, I don't.
Possibly the biggest waste of time and whiteboard meeting in the history of cricket.
Oh, I agree with you. But what I'm saying is that's what they're choosing to do. So because it's the 100, it's they're going to say they're outs. Whereas if they're playing test cricket or one day cricket or T20 cricket, they're wickets.
I don't think people say wickets very often. Really? He's got 4 wickets, maybe. Coming in for his 5th wicket. Or, you know, I don't know.
But that's what cricket is.
Well, the wicket is the stumps. Ben Everill's been good enough to join us. PGA Tour Media Manager after a big week at Augusta National for the US Masters. Hideki Matsuyama making history. And Benny was all over it as always. Benny, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Yeah, pimento cheese is still pimento cheese, no matter what you call it. It's still gross. So I understand where you're going with it.
To all these highfalutin sports administrators who are trying to change things for the crazy kids out there, and it's not really working.
Patrons are fans, or fans are patrons. I mean, we could go down this road for a while.
Yeah, there you go. At Augusta National, are very much patrons, as you well know. As you well know. And they would have been cock-a-hoop yesterday to see Hideki Matsuyama hold on, Benny, in quite dramatic circumstances, particularly the last four or five holes where it got a bit tight.
Yeah, look, it was obviously a massive day for the world of golf, the international scene of golf, with Hideki holding on and becoming the first Japanese male to win any major, let alone a green jacket. And I think, yeah, the people that were there, they really understood that this was a historic moment they were witness to, and perhaps, you know, something that people will look on for all of time. And, yeah, look, Hideki was always going to get a little nervous. He started nervous. He was able to then sort of stoically regather himself and had that five-shot lead for a while. Until Xander, the guy who I thought was going to have the stones to do it, put the heat on. Unfortunately for him, as soon as he really had a chance, he choked. And then Hideki was able to sort of cruise home and get it done just by a shot.
Because it could have been very different. I mean, coulders and wooders and all that sort of stuff was a bit of a waste of time at times. But had he landed one close on 16, Xander, it could have been a very, very dramatic finish.
Look, it's kind of unforgivable what Xander did, to be honest. I'm being a bit harsh. I love the guy. He's one of my favourites. I even spoke to him a few times earlier a few months ago, saying I wish he was an Aussie because he's just got a great fighting spirit. But he could have hit that ball anywhere else but the water. And I'm telling you, Hideki would have had a hard time hitting his shot after it. He'd just gone three in a row. Hideki had admitted that he felt the need to press on 15 because of Xander's run. Ended up making a bogey trying to do that. Two shots and you've got the tee at 16 on the hole-in-one pin. You could have hit it up top bank. You could hit it anywhere that wasn't in the water, and I guarantee you Hideki would have had so much pressure on his shot that he may have made the mistake that Xander made. So, look, it was a massive moment. It took all the pressure off it. I'm not sure if the vision picked it up because I was out there, but Hideki took a big sigh of relief and the head went back. He was very happy to see that ball go in the water. Let me tell you, he was starting to really feel the heat. And it just helped him ease his way home. And I mean, I know that the scorecard says he won by one, but we know as soon as you put it in the fairway on 18, he was pretty much home and hosed. And despite the fact he needed to tap in for a bogey, that was the moment. That was the killer blow right there.
And I think, Ben, that was the fascinating part of the final round, was that so many players at the top of the leaderboard had never won a major before, let alone a Masters. So it was really going to be intriguing to see what sort of the quality of the golf in that final round. And in the end, it was just a hang-on job.
Yeah, look, what was really interesting to me is that there were all those guys, including our man Leish, who could have put the heat on. Everybody knew Hideki was going to be nervous. Everybody knew that he's probably at best going to shoot even par.
Yep.
So it was a matter of if you could get after it, you might be able to beat him. Now, immediately out of the gate, I don't know if Hideki's first drive was so far right that you thought, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
This could be a Norman. You know, this could be a shocker. And by the time he'd finished that first hole, his four-shot lead was one. But he was able to regather from there. And then things kind of got a little bit dull, to be honest. It looked like he was on a procession. And if it wasn't for the fact that we'd all sat and watched Spieth take a five-shot lead at the turn in 2016 and dump 10 balls into Rose Creek, it felt like, then we would have thought it was over. But just as it came to that spot, just as the scoring holes came, the only two guys that actually ever had a real crack was young Zalatoris and Xander. And we finally got some of that back nine, you know, excitement that we all crave at the Masters. And I'm glad we got that, but I'm also glad that Hideki did hold on in the end because, as I said, just a historic day. So great for Japan. And, like, I think I wrote in my story, you know, he was an idol before that. Now he's an immortal. He'd just be forever the greatest to them. And, you know, who knows? We might end up with him lighting the Olympic torch in Japan later this year. He's that bigger name there already.
Yeah, we were talking about that before. I mean, it's crazy just the significance of the win from that perspective. I'm interested, Ben, being out there on the course, how the course was set up, because we were commenting just yesterday about how the greens almost looked like Royal Melbourne there on the final day. They looked hard, they looked dry, they almost looked purple at times. And we spoke to Ian Baker Finch in the build up to the Masters, and he forecast this was likely. It felt a bit different watching it this year.
1,000,000%. After DJ went 20 under in November, I'm surprised that Matsuyama even got to double digits in the end. We were expecting it might be much more difficult. And I think if we didn't have that little rain delay, which, of course, he took very much advantage of, he came out right after and made his six birdie run in seven holes, or six shots in seven holes, because he was just soft enough for that little bit of a period, because they've been sucking the air out of from the sub-air every other day, making that thing as close to dead as possible. We finally had the hard and fast Masters. We had that Royal Melbourne-style greens, obviously a little bit different setup with a lot more trees and azaleas, but it was a real test. And the greens there, they are, that's what they are. You have to have precision angles. You have to know where you're going. You have to know how to play it high or low, and that's why we usually get so many great champions there. You have to have it all. And look, Hideki, he joins the Green Jacket Club. He's a good mate of Adam Scott's, as you guys know as well. So if it wasn't going to be Leash, it's good that it's Hideki.
Tell you what else is terrifying. Driving really fast, around in circles when other people are trying to do the same thing. And that's what Scotty McLaughlin's going to be doing throughout the IndyCar season. We know him as a supercar champion, and it's great to have him testing himself on the global stage in the IndyCar series. We love him on Balls and Bumpers with Jack Riewoldt, one of the podcasts at RSN 927. He's back again, ready for a big season. Good morning, Scott Lee.
Hey, guys. How you going? Well, it's afternoon for me, but I guess it's morning for you guys. No drama.
Definitely morning for us. So happy afternoon to you, but it's definitely morning for us. How you feeling, mate? How you feeling about everything?
I'm excited. Yeah, I'm as prepared as I can be ahead of, you know, a pretty big test. But I think the only thing I'm sort of lacking right now is just utter experience. So I'm feeling good. Yeah, it's a matter of just putting it all together when it counts.
Are you creating a level of interest from pit lane and what the other teams are they looking at you to see what you're getting up to and what you might be able to achieve this season?
I mean, I guess it's a little bit of intrigue. It's pretty, you know, a lot of people are pretty excited about the prospect of, you know, myself, Romain Grosjean from Formula One and Jimmy Johnson from NASCAR being like the rookie class of the field. But, you know, everyone keeps their cards pretty close to their chest, you know, around testing and stuff. Very similar to how we do it in Australia. But, yeah, it's been, I'm pretty excited. It's going to be awesome start of the year. I've got 3 weeks in a row. So if I don't know where I shape up after this block of three events, I'll never know. So really excited. Three ones, road course, street course, and oval. So really excited.
I know, Scott, being a professional athlete, as you are, there's always pressure. But do you feel the pressure? Is there a lot of pressure in the build-up to this, or is it a bit of a, not a free swing, but this is sort of, you've got nothing to lose, this is a whole new experience for you? How do you treat it?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I guess in some ways I put more pressure on myself than anyone, but, you know, there is pressure there, there's expectation, but at the same time, you know, this is what I've always wanted to do. I've wanted to race every weekend, so I'm so excited to be able to start that journey this weekend. And, you know, if we go good, it's fantastic. If not, you know, I've got time on my hands. It's not like I have to, you know, be right there straight away. You know, Penske have, you know, been very straight up and down with me in regards to the time that they've got with me, and they understand it's not going to happen straight away, but it could as well. You know, it could be. So I don't know. We'll see how we go. But for me, pressure, you know, it's there. But, you know, like I said, I put more pressure on myself than anyone put on me.
Take us through the experience of driving at 360 kilometres an hour, as you have been doing in recent times. That's the first part. And then the second part is, explain to us what drafting is.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's pretty crazy, the whole speed thing. I think I was like 378 I clipped up. So I was gassing it, but it was a lot of fun. Far out. You don't hear the engine noise. Like, it's all just wind noise. It's crazy. Like, the buffeting and stuff you get at that speed. But very surreal. Such an awesome place, Indianapolis Motor Speedway. To, you know, to be part of that whole spectacle of the Indy 500 is going to be so exciting. But the second part of your question, drafting. So basically, the best way I can explain it is just the person in front of you, he or she will poke a massive hole in the air. If they're the lead car and you can tuck right in behind them and get a draft or like a faster speed, so you don't have to push the air unlike they do. So they have to combat the air, and you get that little draft where you're just in clean air, and you can just go as fast as you want. It's very hard to explain. I've actually never had to explain draft before, so that's a first. So it's very difficult.
Well, you did a pretty good job. I think we know where you're going with that. So that's okay. Yeah. A question off the SMS, which I was thinking about as well. You're a full-time rookie. What do the other rookies do? They just sort of come in and out when they please.
Yeah, so basically, Romain and Jimmy, they're not running the oval. So basically, they're just doing the road course races. So, right. I mean, you can do that if you have to do it. I don't know if I agree with it, because I think IndyCar is built on, you know, that's the coolest thing about IndyCar. It's ovals and road courses, all very different disciplines, you know, and that's what separates it from Formula One as well. So I'm really excited to contest the full calendar and get the full IndyCar experience. And, you know, I think a lot of the fans as well respect that, which is pretty cool. So I'm sort of understand that the history of, you know, the sport has come a long way with ovals. It's a massive part of oval racing. So I'm excited to be a part of that.
Today we'll head to RSEA Park, the Old Moravian Footy Ground, and find out what the hell happened on the weekend with the Saints. It was quite a comeback, quite the story, and Brad Crouch was out there, his first win in Saints colours. Great to have him part of the Inner Sanctum in 2021. Crouchy, good morning.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Now, the Gatorade shower, how did it go for you? Did you get any in the eyes? Did it sting?
I haven't had one of them in a long time, so it wasn't very nice being on the end of it. And there was hardly any Gatorade. It was all ice cold water, so it sort of took my breath away. It was no good.
You just got the recovery early, the ice bath early. That was all right.
Exactly.
You did a job.
That's what I said. Didn't have to do that.
It was quite the day, I must admit. I was watching from home and I thought, well, the Eagles get to 33 points. And, the Saints are in a bit of trouble here. It's going to be a talking point through the week. And then somehow, and only you can tell us, somehow you turned it around. What happened?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, sort of at half time, we were down by 5 goals or whatever it was at half time, and it sort of didn't feel like that at all. Like, it felt like we were really in the game. I think it was still doing pretty well around the ball, just coughing the ball up a little bit and being a little bit stupid with some of the decisions we were making going forward, which sort of cost us goals. So we sort of really felt like we were in the game, even though it might not have looked like it. And then, pretty midway through the third quarter, it really started turning for us. And you could really sense that out in the ground. And we didn't really take advantage of it that well, really, in the third quarter. But then it really started opening up in the last quarter. We could score a lot better.
I'm interested, Brad, about that feeling in the first half, because I must confess, I was a bit surprised. Brett Ratton was interviewed at half time and he said, we're 5 goals down. I'm not too concerned. There's a lot there that I like. I think we can fix up the things that we're doing poorly and get back into the game. So did he talk about that during half time? I assumed he did, but was he measured as opposed to getting really angry when you're 5 goals down?
Yeah, definitely. I think, as a midfield group, we got together and we were saying that, you know, we felt really good. We thought the way we were setting up was really good, and we sort of felt we were a little bit unlucky to that point. And then, you go in for your meeting with the whole team, and Rat sort of said the same thing. Like, we've got a lot of things here that are going well. We're just giving them a few chances, and they're taking them at the moment. So sort of stick at it and stick to what we're doing, and it'll turn. And sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't as well. But on the weekend it was good because it turned and we started playing the footy we know we can play.
Now, I understand you've only played 2 games for St Kilda, but I'm interested in your early thoughts on Brett Ratton and his coaching style. And it feels it's full of positivity and he gives a real confidence to the group. Talk about what you've experienced in your early phase at the Saints with Brett.
Yeah, it definitely, them two things are really explained well. He really wants you to play your own game and back yourself and play with flair. And, he really encourages players to bring what they're good at. I think at the moment too, we're still a pretty young group and pretty inexperienced group, really. I guess last year was a great year for the footy club. But we're still building towards something as well. So he understands that there's going to be some hiccups in between. And, you know, in such a long season, he talks about the sort of journey of a season at different times. And, you know, it can go up and down. And, it's already done that. It's only round four for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's such a long year and there's going to be lots of ups and downs. And he sort of can guide us all through that. So, you know, he's really good and I've enjoyed having his coach.
So I'm keen to find out what you reviewed, how the review went, Brad, in the team meeting. Was it the first half where you were almost played okay but gave them looks, or was it the second half where you really did start to dominate the game?
Yeah, we watched a little bit of both, actually. So we watched a little bit of how we were losing at half time, and then... Yeah, watched some vision of, you know, all the good stuff that happened after half time and some of our pressure and, you know, we just, you know, it almost looked like a different team. And once that momentum comes, I think, you know, momentum these days in footy is as big as ever.
Yeah.
But you've also got to make the most of it. You could see West Coast were really trying to hang on at different times and they were doing a pretty good job of it. But then, you know, once you pepper them through over and over and over again, you're eventually going to get through. And we sort of just did that and kept at him, and we were pretty ruthless on to the sort of last side, which was great.
And just on the vision, not so much in the review, but during the game, we've noticed last couple of years there's been iPads out there at the quarter time, three quarter time breaks. We've seen the big plasmas in the rooms at half time for some review stuff as well. Do you like the fact that you can get access to vision through the game? Is that the way you'd like to learn, or are you able to just be told what's happening and be able to fix things on the fly?
Yeah, I'm one. I like the vision. Sometimes I get cloudy when I get, you know, asked to remember a centre bounce that happened, you know, half an hour ago or something like that, or a stoppage. So I really like seeing the vision, and it's a good visual sort of tool for me. But I know there's other players that don't like it at all. So it's sort of, you know, it's 50-50. We don't watch a heap of vision at the moment in terms of on game day. We do a lot of it beforehand. But yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, with technology these days, it's going to be around. There's only going to be more and more of it. So I like it. I'm all for it.
I want to go back a couple of weeks since we last spoke to you, Brad. Just the first game experience, and it obviously didn't go particularly well. And then how the team went well, but you yourself went so well in your second game. What was it like to be back playing again, albeit in a different jumper, and just that whole experience of the highs and the lows?
Yeah, it was great. You know, to finally play, I was really looking forward to it. And yeah, I was actually really nervous. I felt really nervous going to my first game, which is, you know, for the club it was weird, but also, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to come here as well was to, you know, go to a different side and be out of my comfort zone and go through all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I was nervous, and we obviously had a terrible performance last week as well, so it was really hard to get involved in the game, and really felt really like a really hard day. So it was just, a really disappointing loss. And so, like, you know, I think me, along with a lot of other players, really built myself up last week to put in a big, strong performance, because there's a lot of players, you know, the last few weeks were down on form. And, I think a few of us got a little bit of form back on the weekend. And it was good to see.
So I was going to ask you about that, whether you were conscious of anything particular that you wanted to focus on in the next week, because the Saints essentially were put on notice after what had happened the week before. I mean, looking at your statistics, it's not just the 26 disposals, it's not just the fact that you had 15 contested possessions, but you also had 12 tackles. We know you were someone that gets a lot of the footy, but I'm just interested in what you really focused on to kind of make a bit of a statement yourself as a new star recruit.
Yeah, I was mainly, my whole focus all week was contest and pressure, and going to the game I went with that as well. That's virtually, I think I brought that in the weekend. I think one of the reasons, in looking back to when I first come to the footy club, I think when I played my best footy years ago at Adelaide, when we were a really strong team, we were a fast pressing team with high pressure, and that sort of really suited me. And I thought, you know, back particularly when we were good in 2017, my pressure was really high. And I think that's something over 2019, 2020 that, you know, I fell away a bit. And whether that was the way we were playing as a team, but that was definitely one of the things that, you know, when I knew St Kilda were interested, the way they play really excited me. And I thought that'd suit the way I'd play as well, a high pressure game and high contest team. So, I just want to keep bringing that and playing that role for the team, and I'm hoping I can keep doing that.
Well, Saints fans, I'm sure, are hoping that as well. One man who they were very, very keen to see play well on the weekend was Bradley Hill. Now, the whole football world had descended upon Bradley Hill for his, in their eyes, lack of output, and certainly for the contract that he's getting, which is a conversation that people get into as well. How was he in the week, last week, building up to that game against West Coast? Because everyone was coming for him.
Yeah, everyone was. I think over the last few weeks before that, a lot of people get into him. It's sort of, you know, it's hard because he's such a... Well, I see him at training, and I've been excited to play with him, seeing what he's done all pre-season, and he's a gun player. And so it's frustrating, not just for him, but for, you know, his teammates and stuff like that, that see, you know, we know how good he is. It's so hard, like, people just watch the game on TV and judge it from the way he kicks the ball or whatever it is sometimes, and it's frustrating because we know how good he can be, and then he shows it on the weekend. So it's, you know, he's played, I think, 3 premierships and won the best and fairest and played 180 games or something. It's, you know, sometimes you just got to sit back and try not to get too angry after a loss and blame someone.
Hey, Saturday and then a grueling game, particularly to come back the way you did, and then Thursday night. At what point in the week, Brad, do you feel physically and mentally ready to go again? Because it's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, definitely. That's the thing. Over the last few days, we've had to do a lot of recovery. And even today, we're in our main training session today, and it won't be a lot at all because it's just all recovery when you get a really short break like this. I pulled up pretty well, but some players pull up worse than others. Sometimes we might manage players going into games like this because it's a high risk for injury. I don't think about it too much at all because it's just, you know, you still get a chance. I actually like the short breaks because you don't have to train as much and you just get out there and play. I think a lot of players are like that.
So what's recovery? We hear a lot of footballers talk about it. A week, it's just going to be recovery. For you and for St Kilda, what does that exactly mean, recovery?
Virtually a lot of it is your nutrition straight after game, so eating the right foods after the game to make sure you recover. Your sleep's probably the most important thing, which is a real issue for some, myself included. I really struggle to wind down from games, so I normally end up at 1 or 2 in the morning watching TV and after a night game because you're sort of still really wound up. So your sleep's pretty big, and then obviously the ice baths and the stretching and the massage and physio and all that sort of stuff as well. So we look at it sort of the 3 different things that you need to do well to sort of recover as quick as you can and give yourself the best chance to play well.
Fresh soldiers are pretty handy in short breaks. Will Rowan Marshall, will he get up for the game this week?
After the way he played when he came back on the weekend, I'm reasonably confident. But I'm not 100% sure with him. He was limping around a little bit in the last couple of days, but I'm not sure. We've also got Paddy, who might be right. We're not sure about him either. There's a few guys that are touch and go, but we saw how valuable Rowan was on the weekend when he came in.
Yeah, I feel like he's the right guy. I'm not sure how Bucks can help us win contested ball on the weekend.
And we've seen some edits today where we're actually going against what we stand for as a side, and I feel like we're pretty united in how we want to play and our understanding of it. We're just not executing, getting beaten around the footy, so we just want to address that. For us, we just need to get cracking, get to work. There was none of these questions asked after round 2 when we had a good win.
I don't think it's make or break. We obviously want to win. Well, I think the main one's just around our contested ball. And that's just not within the stoppage, that's forward and behind the ball as well. So, we need to fix those issues. I don't think it's ever good to just give games
to young kids either. I don't think that really helps. We've got some great kids. It's just making sure we bleed them through the side at the right stage.
No gifting, says the skipper, Scott Pendlebury from the Magpies. They are certainly front and centre in the news cycle at the moment. A bit of contest action they need to fix up as well. Some things in the review they didn't quite like. They are certainly top of the agenda in the world of footy at the moment. Johnny Ralph basically runs the agenda in footy from the Herald Sun. He's the buzz. You can catch him on Fox Footy doing great things as well. Ralphie, good morning.
Hello, boys. Hey, you found another one in Brad Crouch, haven't you? Inside and the honesty and all the things you want in those kind of player interviews. He's wasn't sure what to think of him when he came across on Reasonable Money, but geez, he fronted up on the weekend, and he certainly fronted up just then. He's been a cracker.
Yeah, we're very happy with Crouchy, and it's about integrating them into your world and making them part of the system rather than just the person on the other side of the microphone. And he's bought into that beautifully, which we love from our Inner Sanctum boys through the AFL season, Ralphie. Tell us about the Magpies, though. They are under enormous pressure. Nathan Buckley is out of contract at the end of the season. He's got a decision to make about how young he goes. Is the season over? Are they building towards the next flag, or are they trying to survive and cling on for this one?
You know what? I think all those things are really valid. I always go back to, you know, coaches and when they're struggling. You know, are their best players playing well? And as Dennis Pagan always said, you're a champion coach if you've got champion players who are fronting up. I just look at Jordan Ngoi, and I think he's a massive part of the solution, but he's also a massive part of the problem. You know, here it is plain and simple. He's the most overrated player in the competition right now. You know, you look at all of those players on $800,000 for Collingwood. You know, Brodie Grundy and Darcy Moore and Pendlebury and Howe. You know, they're all playing solid football, and if, you know, Grundy hasn't played as well as he might like to in the last couple of weeks, you know, he's a dual All-Australian and he's a dual Best and Fairest winner. I mean, I just keep looking at, you know, players out there like Jake Stringer or players there like there for nearly the best part of a decade in Dustin Martin. Losing weight, getting fit, getting stripped, getting lean, getting hungry. And this bloke is according to Champion Data, he's an average player right now. And I think that's all he is. He's got two coaches' votes out of a possible 40. So, yes, I know they need to go younger and they'll play Finlay Macrae this weekend. You know, they'll consider Mark Keane and maybe whether they should throw someone like Darcy Moore forward. But if your best players aren't playing well, well, all that comes back to the coach and the focus on the coach and whether the players love the coach. So, look, he's one of the elements of it. He's just got to play better and he's got to do everything possible to get fit. And I'm just not sure that he's cut fit like so many players across the competition, including his captain, Scott Pendlebury.
Ralphie, there's been a lot of commentary about Nathan Buckley and Collingwood in the last 24 hours, and that was always going to happen. It was quite predictable, and that's fair enough because it is Collingwood and they're 1-3. What's your inside word on Nathan and the players, and are they all still behind him as they have been? What's your view on that?
You know, I think they hit a sweet spot, didn't they, for a couple of years through that 2018-19 period. I mean, every coach had some paint stripped off them in terms of their relationships, in terms of what happened in the hub. I suppose the one issue for me that's still unexplainable is that COVID breach for Nathan Buckley, you know, in the middle of 2020, and, you know, the exact circumstances of that and whether the players, you know, really felt like they were frustrated by the fact that, you know, it just interrupted their season again and, look, he had to go into quarantine if only for 24 hours. So, look, I think there were some players there who were less than thrilled with exactly what happened in that circumstance. But what we also have to say is that Steele Sidebottom, who was the Collingwood vice-captain, you know, committed an even more egregious breach. And so, look, I think if you're a Collingwood player, it's the same as the salary cap drama. You know, there's a way in which you're thinking, OK, well, I've just lost my best mate and I'm not really happy about this. But if I was a Collingwood player, I'd be thinking to myself, I need to perform right now because we've actually seen what happens. If you don't perform, they get rid of you. And so I think it's a double-edged sword. Yes, you can be upset about it. Yes, you can be upset about Nathan Buckley and that COVID breach. But at the end of the day, a lot of these players are getting paid extraordinary money, and it's just beholden upon them to perform and potentially to perform against West Coast. Otherwise, they'll be out of the side.
I'm reading between the lines here, Buzz, from what you're saying. Are you suggesting that the players have gone cold on Nathan Buckley?
No, I just think in that specific circumstance, some of those players were potentially frustrated that Buckley would commit what was a pretty obvious breach there, whether it was playing tennis or whatever that circumstance was. So, look, Tom Morris has talked about that, and he said that some of the senior players, you know, the likes of Brodie Grundy and Jordan Ruff had about honest conversations. Now, I'm not aware of that, so I'm not here saying that Collingwood players are going cold on him. You know, he's always had the biggest defender of all time in Scotty Pendlebury, and Scotty loves what Nathan does. He works hard. He rolls his sleeves up. He tries to get the best out of himself. I don't think the Collingwood issue right now is a relationship thing. It's just they've potentially picked the wrong side. They've definitely stripped a lot of depth, which they haven't replaced right now. And the kids they'd love to bring in, like Caleb Poulter and Reece McGuinness and Mark Keane and Will Kelly, a few of those guys have just had interrupted pre-seasons that just haven't allowed them to be in the side right now. You know, they played Ollie Henry in round one. He was on the downswing of his form. He had four possessions. They've got to play him in the twos. Now, you can say, they must play all the kids. But if they played Ollie Henry and he had a possessionless game, they might set him back 6 weeks. I think in 4 weeks, they'll be playing better. Hopefully, they're getting more out of Brodie Grundy, whether it's physicality or contested marking or goals. You know, what's plan B for you, Brodie? But I also think we'll be seeing the likes of Mark Keane, and I think they'll be experimenting. I mean, what better chance for them to throw a player forward of the calibre of Darcy Moore? He kicked 24 and 24 goals in his 25 goals in his first 2 years. They're crying out for some sort of spark there, and at least throw him forward to see that if it's not by the end of the year that forward line doesn't get it done with him, then you say, okay, well, maybe Mychek's on the table, or maybe Mason Cox is on the table. Those blokes have done well for them in finals, but there's a lot of games in which Mason Cox just doesn't get it done for the Collingwood forward line, and the entire forward line almost has to run through him, given he's the tallest player in football.
Spargo, under pressure there, over the top to Melchior, and now a goal. That just about gets it done.
Well, that was the sealer on the weekend. The D's too good for the Cats by 25 points, 85 to 60. And one of the reasons they are going gangbusters, 4-0 to start the season for the first time since JC played halfback for Jerusalem. Ed Langdon is dominating
They're
on the
Jerusalem
week.
Jack Jumpers.
Jerusalem, I don't know. We'll come up with a name for them shortly. Ed Langdon's on the line from the Demons, though, the Melbourne Football Club. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, guys. How you going?
Going well, mate. Not as well as you guys, though. We've got Maxie in here every now and then. We have a good chat to Big Max. But getting someone else's feedback on what's happening will be nice. How have you seen it? What's happened? What's been the difference this year?
Yeah, it's been great. I think it's just been sort of a culmination of the last few years and sort of just growing up. The group's as mature as it's been. And that's sort of coming out in games, as you can probably tell. Sort of been down and up against them just about every game I've played this year, and remained really calm and just got done what we needed to. And yeah, we're sitting here 4-0, which we're pretty happy about.
There seems to be, and I'm only watching from afar, clearly. I've seen you live once this year. There seems to be really good chemistry and connection. Now, it's hard to define that. It's hard to quantify it or train it, I imagine. But it just seems to be real. It flows better at the moment for the D's. Is that a fair reflection on what's happening, or am I making that up?
Yeah, no, exactly right. It's really hard to manufacture that sort of stuff. But when you can, it seriously pays dividends. I mean, you can train all the structures in the world and all the tactics, but if you don't have a good group dynamic, you're never going to play well. So that's something we've consciously strived towards this year. And maybe it's as a result of living together for 6 months last year. I'm not sure, but... it's certainly all coming together and clicking for.
So do you think that you coming to the footy club, Stephen May, certainly Jake Lever, that has helped you grow up as a football club, having new people with different experiences coming into that particular group?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm sure that absolutely helps. Like, Steve was captain of another AFL club, so that sort of experience is invaluable. And then, I mean, Adam Tomlinson's played almost 150 games when he was moved over, and Jack played in the granny. So yeah, you inevitably get a lot of experience and training players in, and yeah, those three guys have been fantastic this year. Unfortunately, Steve probably out a little bit, but as we saw, Tomo filled that role really well on the weekend.
Now, I'm not sure whether you're allowed to tell us this, but the other week you played the entire game. You didn't go off. What sort of GPS figures did you run in that particular game to not have a break?
In that particular game, it probably would have been the ballpark of, I don't know, 16Ks in that one, I reckon.
So did that happen by accident, or was that always the plan? Because for a midfielder to play 100% game time doesn't happen very often, if ever.
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious thing. It wasn't sort of part of the plan, but most of the pre-season it's sort of been put on the plate by the fitness staff that that would likely be happening with me, which I'm, you know, more than happy to do. And it's sort of just, I think it comes down to matchups and sort of game state on game day every week. So it's sort of up to Goody and the fitness staff what they want to do and if they want to manipulate matchups or something. But yeah, if they require me like they did that week to play 100%, yeah, that's fine with me.
So do you prefer that? I mean, a lot of players would don't want to have a rest, but then there are other midfielders that feel that it gets the best out of them by having it. Because it could potentially buck the trend of what happens with midfielders if you can prove that you can do it and still play really good footy. I'm just interested in your feedback on that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think if it's at the cost of the team, it's obviously going to be detrimental to everyone. But if you can run out a game, and there is certainly a premium on players who can at the moment, with the rule changes coming back in this year.
Yeah.
The reason I sort of do it is, well, I'm allowed to do it is, because if it allows me to, allows us to rotate the inside mids a lot faster, and like Christian, Clayton, all them, if they can get one or two more rotations and they're fresher, because they're power athletes, and they thrive on, you know, short, sharp bursts. So if that allows them to play better and ultimately the team, then I'm sure that's sort of the big reason behind it.
Yep.
Well, it works a treat at the moment. You're connecting beautifully between the arcs, you are. You're running back to help. You're pushing forward to get involved as well. And I haven't got the data in front of me, Ed, but anecdotally, I would imagine your kicking efficiency's gone through the roof, and you've been working on that a bit over the summer, have you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mark Williams has come in and implemented one of his famous kicking programs, which we'd all heard about. but, no, honestly, it's been unbelievable what he's done for our group. We've gone from pretty much zero fundamental kicking and training to like a minimum of almost half an hour a day. And he never makes it boring. He changes the drill every single day. So I don't think we've done the same drill twice. And he brings such energy to each training. He's like a kid at school, Choco. So yeah, he's done wonders for me. And I would hazard a guess the whole group's kicking efficiency has probably gone up in some degree. But, yeah, his impact on the group's been phenomenal.
Rocket Eade, speaking of doing awesome things, he did that for over 600 games as a player and the coach in the AFL system. Now he does it with us on a Tuesday morning on The Breakfast Club, and he's back again. Rocket, good morning.
Morning, Daniel Whitey. How are you going, boys?
We are well. We are well. We're 4 weeks in. Rocket, have you got a feel for what's happening in footy at the moment?
I've got a feel that it's going to be unpredictable. I don't. You know, people are saying, "Oh, the top eight's nearly set." Oh, I'm not. I don't canvass that. I reckon teams that have won four in a row will at some stage hit a wall, fall over. Others that will get on a streak. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll be an exciting season, to be honest.
There's a bit to talk about with you today from a coaching perspective, because we've got different ends of the spectrum we can tap into. The biggest one is clearly what's happening at Collingwood and the pressure that now is firmly on Nathan Buckley for many and varied reasons. What do you do if you're Bucks, you've been at the footy club, you've been in that position as a senior coach, and I imagine under a fair bit of pressure through your time, Rocket, as well as a senior coach. What do you do if you're Bucks at the moment?
I think with Nathan, he does cope with pressure pretty well. So, but by the same token, it does infiltrate your psyche. But his main focus is going to be A, the team, and B, the players, and how we get them to turn around. I just take it back to probably the end of 17, where probably there was a heap of pressure and where he kept his job. And they changed things up. They changed their style. They had a bit more freedom, I suppose, play a bit more abandoned. At the moment, they seem to be playing the same old bloke, players in the same position, don't do anything different. The game has changed, the game has moved, and it moves on anyway.
Yep.
I think they'll make some changes at selection table, and I think it's been proven with a lot of kids, even the Giants at the weekend, which was forced, but how much enthusiasm that gave the team, and I think just got to give it a different look. Players in different positions, move them around, move the magnets a bit, probably open them up. I think their biggest issue, is that the right phrase? Which has been their strength is their midfield now, with Treloar gone, Adams injured, Penderbury still playing well, but he's a bit older, side bottom a bit older. They haven't got that advantage over the other teams. Well, I suppose with Grundy not playing as well, they're not that dominant in the midfield with a forward on that doesn't kick goals. So that's going to be an issue, but now you can spark something. So it just needs to be creative, I think.
So from a selection perspective, you're talking about that before, about changing the mix a bit and getting a different look, different dynamic. And after four rounds and you're 1-3, and they could very easily have been 2-2, and it could have been a different conversation. After four rounds, are you starting to think about what your year can look like and whether or not it's feasible, viable, the right thing to do to keep trying to hang on to this season? Or do you start to look about what the next 2 or 3 years look like, and particularly for someone like Bucks, who's out of contract at this year?
Oh, I don't think their season's dead. As I said in the intro, I think teams will have three or four weeks, even the Melbourne and Sydney of that at some stage will fall over, and I've got no doubt the teams will get on a roll. So I think you're always going to be in it unless you're mathematically completely out. Like, they're 1-6, 1-7, okay, your season's finished. But it's a tough one this week going to Perth, but they've proven historically that they can win that. And then they've got three games that they can win. So I certainly wouldn't be giving up hope, but they can spark, they need a spark of enthusiasm. It doesn't seem to be some enthusiasm there. And you can spark players by giving them different roles, different focus points, different thoughts on the game, take the shackles off a little bit. I don't think their season's dead, but by the same token, I think he needs to get some youngsters in there. And it's been proven, as I said, with other teams. They've got some youngsters in, and it sparked their team. So maybe that's the way they'll go this week.
So is it as simple as that, of just changing it up a little bit personnel-wise, or are there any things positionally that you would do or methodology you would do with Collingwood to give them that sort of, it's not an artificial spark, it's the trigger for the spark?
Yeah, I think the same as too is about their style a bit. I think you can spark it. You've got to, by sparking enthusiasm, you're really changing the psyche. You change the mentality of players. So A, a different role. B, the team play a different way, or we'll tweak some things at certain stages, what we do, how we back the players to, like, they're making mistakes anyway, back them to not be, I'm not saying they are constrained, but no, we'll kick in this certain spot, and this is what we're going to do when we get the ball in this position of the ground. But okay, let's the players express themselves a little bit more, which is probably foreign to Nathan a little bit, but I think they did that in 18 after 17. They really did. They defend really well. I mean, the Giants got 90 at the weekend, which is unheard of against Collingwood, and it's a bit wet. But generally, they defend really well. So you've got that as your basis. Let's try and attack a bit more. Let's take the game. If we turn it over, we can defend the turnover pretty well. We don't kick goals. And probably, I know he's short, I know we talk about him a lot to Goey, but he wins his one-on-ones a lot. Let's make him the focus point, not Cox the focus point. Let's change the structure a little bit. And back to that original point, get some kids in. And some of them may not be ready. You can't play, I don't think you can play 5 and 6 like the Giants had to do at the weekend through injuries. Now, there's a tipping point of playing 2 and 3 and then rotate those 2 and 3 with some kids coming through as well. But I think you can spark the team. And they've got, it's a terrible phrase because you have got something to lose, but they've got nothing to lose. I mean, the pressure's on them. They do respond well to pressure. They do play well away. They do bond well. So I'd certainly give them a chance this week.
I think that's the thing, is that they've got that recent experience of beating West Coast in the final last year, where they did go in with almost a nothing-to-lose attitude. They were a lot more proactive. They did take the game on. They did move the ball quickly against West Coast. If they're going with a similar philosophy, they'd have to think they're a good chance of winning.
Yeah, for sure. I think if you go in, not saying they do, but some teams I've seen in the past, trying to minimise a loss or stay within reach, and with the new rules now, you're not going to score. Yeah. You've got to be able to take the game on in a controlled way sometimes, but at the same time, back the players. Now, you've coached a lot. You've coached system. They know what to do. as in certain situations and stoppages and structures and all that sort of thing. But but the game throws up so many different scenarios. Let the players decide that. Let them take it on. It's going to be mistakes. Let's not pull them up. And I think they can get themselves back. They haven't got the talent they've had in the previous years. So I think they're fighting for a spot in the eight at this stage. I don't think there's any higher honours for them. But by the same token, I think they can get their season back on track.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.